Anybody in here ever grow a garden, a vegetable garden or a flower garden? I know some of you people do that. I know if you drive by Wayne and Mary's house, their front yard looks like just a glorious gray of color in the way they have their house decorated from time to time. Always love to go to the Hooks' house in Dawson. Their house is just beautiful, the decorations that they have around their home. And there's nothing like having a beautiful yard. And a lot of people grow vegetables and have a vegetable garden, you know, and they can bring you joy. Particularly if they are productive, whether it's a beauty garden or whether it's a produce garden. They require a lot of preparation, though, don't they? And they require a lot of maintenance, constant maintenance, to their success. You know, when I was young growing up, I made some declarations about gardens. My daddy had two vegetable gardens every year, one in our backyard and one on my granddaddy's farm. And because of that, I decided that I am not fond of vegetable gardens. Even though I enjoyed the fresh vegetables and fruits that came from the ground, and my daddy was one of the best I've ever seen, with the green thumb, and he could grow anything that would grow on Alabama soil, he grew it, and grew it with ease. But I come to the conclusion that it required too much work and was not worth the effort. And after I met my wife and started hanging around her parents, I developed the concept of my father-in-law. As long as I have a dollar and the grocery store has a can, I'm going to be okay. So that is my take on vegetable gardens, or at least it was when I was a young man. Now that I have grown much older, I see the value of the vegetable garden, both in what it can provide for us and also what I learned when I worked in them, because my dad had me out there every day through the summer working in those gardens. And yes, I do have the knowledge to grow a vegetable garden. And I'll tell you this morning, I can grow any tomato, any potato, any bean, any corn, any squash, any okra, any field of greens, come known to man, because my daddy saw to it that I know how to do that. So just give me some dirt and I can actually do it, even though I'm not going to be happy about it. But I can actually do it. Of course, in biblical times, societies were very agriculturally oriented, and they depended more on their gardens in those days than we did in North Alabama in the 60s and the 70s. And particularly, that is true today. Today, people seem to think, like I like to think, fruits and vegetables are something that come from the grocery store. So it might be difficult for some to relate to a garden and what it takes to produce one. In the Bible times, that would not have been the case. People knew about gardens. Therefore, it is not surprising to find stories in the Bible by the prophets, by the teachers, and by Jesus himself about gardens and gardening in their teachings. Jesus did it. He told parables from the parables of the laborers to the seed for the sower. Now, what I want to do today, I want us to look at two such illustrations concerning gardens, or in this case, vineyards. One is given by Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7, which Bill read for us. And the other is a teaching by Jesus that came from John chapter 15, verses 1 through 10. I call this lesson The Tales of Two Vineyards. These lessons will help illustrate to us important things about God's relationship with his people. There are two kinds of vineyards used here. One is known, as you see on the left, a wild grape vineyard. Now, this is what you're going to find if you're walking through the woods and you happen to walk upon a grapevine that is attached to a tree or to a fence line or whatnot. And the grapes are usually small, and they're in small clusters. Now, they taste okay, but they're not very uniform at all. It is known as a wild grape vineyard. The other one is known as a well-manicured grape vineyard. This is the picture on the right, where you see the perfect lines of the vines and the grapes falling in large groups. The grapes are larger. They have a much richer taste to them. These are the professionally grown grapes. Now, I want to talk about these two kind of vineyards today in our lesson. First of all, I want to talk about the one in Isaiah, chapter 5, verse 1 through 7. This is actually a song, the vineyard song, and is considered to be a parable. A little background on this. In Isaiah chapter 1, verses 25 and 26, the Lord is promised to turn his hand against Israel. Israel has left the Lord. Israel has gone off into left field and doing their own thing, and they have forgotten about God and about God's law. So now he is going to turn his hand against the children of Israel and the faithfulness of their leaders. The purpose is to remove their sin, to restore them to their righteousness, and to restore them as his Israelite nation. In Isaiah chapter 4, verses 5 and 6, God is going to show his mercy, however, to those who have not left him. We read here beginning in verse 5, "Then the Lord will create above every dwelling place of Mount Zion and above her assemblies a cloud and smoke by day and the shining of a flaming fire by night. For over all the glory there will be a covering, and there will be a tabernacle for shade in the daytime from the heat, and a place of refuge for a shelter from storm and rain." Now, what follows next in chapter 5, verse 1 through 7, as Bill has already read for us, it is the song about this vineyard. It presents a picture of God who has become exhausted with Israel because they have not followed through. They have not followed him. They have not served him. They've gone off on their own thing. So here's the song. Song for the beloved about his vineyard. Isaiah 5 verse 1. My well-beloved has a vineyard on a fruitful hill. He is talking about this beautiful ground, this beautiful vineyard, how he dearly loves. Now, it's only likely intended to say that the owner of this vineyard, even though it doesn't give a name or an establishment of him, that he is a loving owner. He loves his vineyard. And it would also indicate that this owner would be one that would be deserving of love. Yet, even though the identity of the owner and the identity of the vineyard is not known, we know that he is talking about himself and the children of Israel. The song describes the richness of the land and how he prepared the soil and how he made everything just right. And we learn that everything he did in verse 2 was for the purpose of reaping a tremendous harvest, to grow a beautiful vine, a beautiful vineyard, beautiful grapes for his purpose. But yet, it only produced worthless ones. Every care had been lavished upon this vineyard, and yet the grapes that were produced were worthless. They were like the wild grapes that you see in the woods. So in verses 3 and 4 of our text, the vine man begins to establish questions about why has my vineyard not grown? The beloved the beloved man says, why has my vineyard done this? O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What was there more for me to do for my vineyard than I have done? Well, when I expected to grow good grapes, it produced worthless ones. How could this have possibly been? And we find in verse 5 and 6 that he immediately calls for a judgment based upon the results of what he has seen in his vineyard. Let me tell you what I'm going to do, he said. I am going to remove its hedge. I am going to allow it to be consumed. I am going to break down its wall, and I am going to allow it to become trampled upon and destroyed. I will lay it to waste. It will not be pruned. It will not be hoed. But the briars will come in, and the thorns will come up, and will choke it and destroy it. And I will also charge the clouds not to rain, to give it nourishment and moisture. This is what the beloved vineyard man is going to do to his vineyard. And then we find in verse 8, he's going to let us know exactly what it is he's talking about here. For the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel and the men of Judah, his delightful plant. Oh, he had so many hopes for Israel. He was using Israel as the centerpiece object to bring the sun, and we know that from later on. He has so many wonderful ideas about this wonderful vineyard, this wonderful nation of Israel. Thus he looked for justice, but found bloodshed. He looked at Israel for righteousness, and behold, he found a cry of distress. Nothing has worked out the way he wanted it to work out. Nothing has grown. Nothing has completed itself. Nothing has worked right, and he did everything he possibly could do to make it work right. So here the nation of Israel stands that was so special to God. They were his special possession, and they were there to receive his love, his goodness, and his grace. But rather than rejoicing with Israel's harvest, there would be destruction because their fruit, their hearts, their actions in no way reflected their owner or his efforts or his dedication or his love for them. So the hope of the Lord for his vineyard has ended in total loss, because Israel nation had an attitude of ingratitude and an attitude of disobedience. You know, this should be a very special warning to us today, because we are told that we are on the vine of Christ and that we are to produce good fruit as his children. And our fruit must be good. Romans chapter 15 and verse 12. I'm sorry, verse 4. For whatever things were written before were written for our learning, that we might, through the patience and comforts of scriptures, may have hope. This story in Isaiah is telling us, as Jesus Christ's servants, how to be the vineyard and how to grow the fruit. So with that thought in mind, I want us to move on to the other vineyard. In this vineyard, we find God's parable of the vineyard and branches, or the vine and branches. John chapter 15 and verse 1, Jesus said, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Jesus is the true vine. This tells us that through Israel, which was the vineyard that the beloved one grew, was God's vineyard of old, and it was vital to his plan, because Jesus would be the new one. Jesus is the one that was going to produce the good fruit. Jesus is the one to do that correctly, which Israel had failed in. And just as in Isaiah's song, the existence of the vine shows us God's great love. You know, in sending Jesus, God provided and sacrificed the greatest of vines for us. John 3:16, "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life." The Father is the vine dresser. And this is very significant because, like the beloved vineyard of Israel, the vine, which Jesus is, and his ministry, as well as the branches, are the disciples who has come from the Father and who are under his control. You know, the work of the vine dresser in John 15 is to help the vine grow in a better way. We read in verse 2 and 3, "Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bears fruit, he prunes it so it may bear more fruit. And you know, you are already clean," he said, "because of the word that I have spoken to you." You know, notice here that the vine dresser's work is directly attained to the branches that are in Jesus. What this means, church, is this: the Father's attention is on me and it is on you. And the work and the fruit that we produce. It is also interesting to note that because of the work of the vine dresser, two things are going to take place here. He is going to remove the unfruitful branches from the vine. I remember as a child, my daddy would always grow corn. And when the corn would get old, maybe 3 foot high, little saplings will start growing at the base. Now, I guess that's just the way corn is. But these little saplings is taking nourishment and nutrients away from the main stalk. My job was to take the hoe and remove those little saplings from around that corn stalk so that the corn stalk would grow in a better way. That's pruning, by the way. We are to be pruned by God so that we can be more effective, that we can do God's work in a greater way and bear more fruit. And here again we see that God in his grace has put this into action so that we can be more successful as his child. And we know that, we understand that pruning, of course, is sometimes not pleasurable. And it often involves pain and hardship and loss. Many years ago, my uncle had a small peach orchard back behind his house. And the peach trees grew, and they sort of got out of sorts, you know, and it made it kind of hard to grow, to pull the peaches in the fall, to harvest them, you know, and whatnot. So he had a man come in to prune his peach trees. And he didn't know what he was getting himself in for. So the man comes up there, and he prunes those peach trees, and my uncle goes out to take a look at them, and there wasn't very much of a tree left. I mean, and how in the world can... Now it's just a scrub stalk. How is these trees going to grow peaches? Well, I want you to know the following spring, every one of those trees branched out. They were thicker, they were plusher, and the fruit was better than they ever have been in the past. The pruning did that. 2 or 3 years ago, Philip planted a crepe myrtle tree or vine out here in the side of our house. So last fall, he says, "I'm going to go out there and prune that tree." And all that was left would be about like my arm. There was no branches on it. It was just a stick standing out on the ground. Drive by there and look at it today. It has greened up. It is beautiful. It's going, I think we're going to get blooms off of it this year. We got one off of it last year. I think we'll get more off of it now. Pruning works, folks. And God knows that. And so sometimes we need to understand it's necessary for us to be pruned as Christians so that we can bear the best fruit that we possibly can. And here's another thought. The only way that we're ever going to reap a harvest, the only way that it's ever going to work, is that we must be on the vine. Now, I have to tell you, when I was a little boy with that hoe in my hand, I couldn't have been more than maybe 10 years old. I didn't like that job. And every now and then when I see that sapling, you know what I would do? I'd cut down that whole stalk of corn. And I thought, there's one I won't have to hoe anymore. Let me tell you, folks, that didn't work out too well for me. That corn stalk died. I had detached the stalk from the root. It's not going to grow anymore. It's going to die. The same thing is true. You know, I love to bring my wife flowers. I don't get to as much as I used to, but I always get her. She loves daisies and she loves the carnations, the color. And so I'll bring those in from the store or from the florist. And oh, they're just so beautiful. After about 2 or 3 days, they're not so beautiful. You know why? All of those flowers have been detached from the vine. They have lost their source of nourishment, and they die. Friends, as Christians, we have got to be attached to the vine. Jesus said in verse 4 of John 15, "Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me." As disciples, we are the branches. We are the followers of Christ. And that means the only way that we're going to be able to bear fruit for him, to serve him, to live for him in a correct way, is to be attached to him. And we need to know that. This means that the power to produce is not in you and me. The power to produce is in Jesus Christ. He has given us the gospel. He has given us the strength. He has given us the ability to share it. So we're not doing any of this on our own. Paul said it's not important who the teacher is. It's not important who the one that puts the water on. The important one is the one who has given it to us. He is the one that matters. And we need to know that. Well, this raises a question. Well, you know, how do we do this? You know, we live our lives trying to abide in Christ. And yeah, we make our mistakes and we do things that are wrong. How do we officially do this and do it in a better way? Well, first of all, we have to love God enough to want to obey him. Now, you know, you go back and you think about your childhood days. Who really wanted to obey? I mean, wouldn't you have just rather done your own thing and go off in your own direction and live like you want to live? I know the older that I got when I was small, I'm thinking, boy, when I get 16 and I get my car, boy, I'm going to take off. Well, I didn't, because I didn't get a car at 16. I had to borrow my daddy's. And the first time I took it out, I drove it a half a mile to Piggly Wiggly, and he told me, I've called everybody along the way, they're going to be watching you. So I didn't get any freedom at all, did I? Not at all. Well, when I turned 18, the state and the government said I was a man. That's it. I'm going to be out of high school. I'm going to be a man on my own. Not a chance, buddy, because I was still living in that same house. And my daddy still barked just as loud as he always had, and I found myself still under control. And I was under control until I was 26 years old when I married her, and then I found out, hey, you're still under control. We've got to attach ourselves to something, some way, somewhere, for us to be what we need to be. And Jesus has said, attach yourself to me. If you want to be on the vine, be on the vine. If you want to grow, you can grow. But you've got to do it my way. Now, there's a flip side to that as well. We have to love him enough to obey him. But because we show our love for God, God is going to love us in return. John 14, verse 23, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word. And my Father will love him. And he will come to him, and we will come to him and make our abode with him. But as Jesus said, whether that happens or not, it's up to you. You don't have to be on that vine. You can take yourself off of that vine, but you need to understand what happens if you detach yourself from that vine. Preaching the word, which now results in new converts, is our responsibility. And we do that by shining God's light through Jesus. Paul said in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8, for you were once darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of light. For the fruit of the Spirit in all goodness and righteousness and truth, finding out what is acceptable to your Lord. In other words, there's a way we have to do it. And we have to do it his way. What is expected of me and you? To bear proper fruit. Not the wild grapes you find in the woods, but that which is beautiful, that which is long-lasting, that which flourishes, that which grows with ease. We need to accept the same mindset that Paul did in Galatians 2 and verse 20. He said, I have been crucified with Christ. I'm not the same person anymore. I'm not like I used to be. It is not no longer I who live, but Christ who lives in me. And the life which I now live, I live in the flesh. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. So you tell me, these two vineyards, which one tells your story and your relationship with God? Are you connected to God's vine, Jesus Christ? The only way to connect yourself is by becoming a Christian. And you can do that today through faith, repentance of sin, confessing Jesus as the Son of God, being buried with him in baptism for the remission of your sins. You can attach yourself to the vine. God will add you to his vine. Isn't that wonderful? And Christian, I have to ask you this. You've been on the vine. I hope you still are on the vine. But are you producing fruit? You see, it could be that you're not letting the Father prune you. You're not letting the Lord make the adjustments that he needs to make in your life to make you a better branch on his vine. Maybe you need to look at that again. Attach yourself back to God in a better way. Change your life. Don't take a chance of the Lord removing you from his vine. This morning, if you need to respond to the invitation, please come while we stand to sing this song.